The Art Newspaper Weekly podcast is brought to you in association with Bonhams, where the historic and modern are equally valued. Welcome to the Art Newspaper Weekly podcast. I'm Ben Luke. This week, we're looking at a unique collaboration between a commercial gallery, Hauser & Wirth, and a non-profit, community-minded art centre, Grisdale Arts, taking place in Somerset.
I think we've lost a lot of knowledge, and we've lost the ways, a lot of ways of creating attachments and relationships to the land and nature.
But first, the front page of the latest print edition of the Art Newspaper, out this week, features a story about an exhibition in the Belgian city of Ghent. It looks at the dubious Russian avant-garde art in the collection of Igor and Olga Toporovsky. It opened last October, but on the 15th of January, an open letter from numerous art world specialists, including dealers, academics and museum curators, appeared in the Flemish daily newspaper De Standaard. It described the works as highly questionable and precipitated a chain of events which led to the works being removed from view in recent days. Simon Hewitt, who wrote our front page story, was already working on the article and reports in great detail on the collectors, their works and the doubts cast about them by numerous specialists. I'm delighted to say he joins me on the line now. Simon, I wonder if you might begin by just giving us a bit of the background to this story, because it's an exhibition which actually opened in October last year.
Well, it did, and I suppose the first thing I could say in terms of background is that these exhibitions, which turn out to be rather questionable, often occur in sort of not terribly prominent places. But no one had really picked up on this exhibition until a Russian artist visited the show on November the 15th. He was called Pavel Odelnov. He happens to be a Facebook friend of mine, and he wrote on the museum's Facebook site saying how shocked he was by the quality of the works. And the museum replied that it had received sufficient guarantees from the owners and sort of kicked it into the long grass. I was in Budapest over Christmas, and I met an art historian who lives there who had been following the story a bit, and he said, "Oh, I know someone who might have some useful information for you." And it turned out to be a Russian police officer who used to be in the sort of the equivalent of the Russian art crime squad. And we spoke on Boxing Day, and I subsequently sent him a few questions, and it turned out that he knew the owner of this collection of Russian art being showed in Ghent. The owner, Igor Toporovsky, used to be in Moscow, and it had been questioned by the police of a sort of art forgery case back in 2006. And so I got a few quotes from the Russian policeman, Nikita Semyonov, about Mr. Toporovsky. And that was sort of quite meaty stuff. And so when I was back in circulation, so to speak, in January, I contacted the art newspaper and said, "I think we have quite a big story here." And that's how it got going. And 2 days later, I went to Ghent.
So tell me about the experience in Ghent. What was the show like? So you've gone there with the idea that there is something dubious about this exhibition. How's it presented? How many? It's 24 works. So how many? Is it single room? How many rooms?
I'd gone there trying to keep an open mind. Of course, yes, people were expressing quite serious doubts, but I do try to keep an open mind on these things. First of all, I called the museum and said, "Could I speak to the museum director? I'll be over in a couple of days." And the museum PR said, "No, she's too busy," in a sort of not very convincing way. But said, "I'll give you a curator to show you around." So I said, "Okay, why not?" It turns out the museum has recently been rehung. The display has been represented. And because the museum director is not actually a specialist either in old masters which dominate the museum or in Russian 20th century art, she's a contemporary specialist, and she's sort of dotted various contemporary works around the museum in a way which is sort of quite trendy these days, if not entirely convincing from an aesthetic point of view. So I was shown around by this curator, but I took the precaution of actually going there unannounced a few hours beforehand to look at the show quietly by myself. Now, when you hear of a show of 24 undiscovered masterpieces of the Russian avant-garde, you think there's going to be pretty strict security going on. And, you know, you're going to be vetted at the entrance. There's going to be special guards guarding the works, or at least in the room where they're shown. And this wasn't the case at all. There was next to no security. I mean, just the usual CCTV camera here and there. The works themselves, 18 of them in one room devoted just to Russian avant-garde. They were all paintings except for two very strange-looking works attributed to Malevich. One looked like a picnic basket, covered in paintings pretty much based on known Malevich works. And the other was something called a distaff, which looked like a sort of old-fashioned cubist hockey stick. So there were 18 works in one room, and there were six other works spread around three other rooms. There was a Jawlensky and a Kandinsky in a room assigned to Flemish Expressionism in the European context. So I suppose that was just about okay. Logically speaking, there was Annenkopf, Rerich, and Larionov in the Hall of Belgian Expressionism, a little curiously. And there was a third Kandinsky hanging next to a Polyakov in a room purportedly devoted to Belgian abstract art.
Uh-huh. So what I hadn't realised was that it was sort of, that the works are sort of dispersed in amongst the collection, very much side by side with works which are known, authenticated, etc.
Yes, they are. And I think when I spoke to Mr. Toporowski the following day, he told me they'd hoped to do this even more. But he said, though, we had a Vrubel, who's a sort of late 19th century Russian expressionist, a very powerful painter. They said, oh, he was too powerful to go in with the other European stuff, so we didn't pursue that idea. But obviously it gives them a certain gloss if they're shown compared to other well-established works in a museum context.
So once you'd seen them, were your curiosities raised all the more than they had been even before you got there? Or how did you respond once you'd seen them?
There were a couple of works which really caught my eye. The first was by Pavel Filonov, an artist from Leningrad, whose pictures are extremely intricate and complicated. And I've seen a lot of his work in Russia. It's not often shown in the West, because it's nearly all in Leningrad or Petersburg. And it's only ever shown in the West in special exhibitions. And this was a dire quality painting by any standards. I mean, you could say, okay, Filonov had a bit of an off day, but the quality of that painting was particularly low. And then there was another work by Rerich, who's a sort of mystical artist who traveled a lot in India and the Himalayas in the 1920s and 30s. And it was a date here which really surprised me, because it was dated 1922, and I was pretty sure that Rerich had never set foot in the Himalayas at that time. And in fact, in 1922, he was in the United States. And so I've got some books on Rerich at home, and I checked that out, and sure enough, he never saw the Himalayas till December 1923 and never went to Tibet, which was the title of this picture, until 1927. So, yes, all this got me thinking, shall we say.
Then how does this narrative fit with the letter that appeared in the Belgian newspaper on the 15th of January?
Well, I'd heard this letter was coming out. It was a question of the timing and exactly who was going to sign it. And I think that decision was made at the last minute in terms of the exact names of the signatories. But of course, when this came out, that sort of prompted an official response, because there were a lot of big names amongst those 10 signatories, both from the dealer world and the curatorial world. And I developed some quite good contacts in Ghent and in Belgium, so I knew how the museum reacted. And they had a sort of early morning crisis meeting at the museum to decide how to react. They ended up issuing a sort of very bland, non-committal statement saying we've had all the necessary guarantees, we've ensued all the right procedures, which was absolute nonsense. They'd been very careful and very casual about the whole business. But the museum staff were given a gagging order by the museum director, and this chimed in with what I saw when I was given my guided tour by a curator when I first went to Ghent. He showed me every single room in the museum. We spent about 2 minutes in each, and when we got to the room with all the Russian art, he just walked briskly past. And, sort of embarrassed silence, if there was sort of plague inside it or something. So that struck me as rather strange. And I heard that some of the museum curators had been surprised when these museums were first hung. They'd said, oh, for instance, the Kandinskys aren't in the catalogue raisonné, in other words, sort of the official listing of all his works. Toporowski, the collector, had said, oh, you can't trust catalogue raisonné, things get added all the time. So there were doubts in the museum, which had been quashed by the museum director.
That's interesting. So once the letter had been written, once the crisis meeting had been had, the response from the museum and indeed from the Ghent cultural authorities was extremely defensive, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly was. I think initially they were hoping they could thrash it out and the controversy would dissipate. But then after this letter came out, there was more and more reaction in the press, particularly in the main Flemish daily, Der Standaard, which did a series of articles with opinions from other curators. And it turned out they'd approached the Luxembourg Museum, which is quite a big museum, and the museum in Luxembourg had said, well, we didn't get any concrete evidence of provenance, so we wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. And so this outcry, which gathered pace for 3 or 4 days, forced the Flemish minister to step in. He stepped in very carefully, as if he was putting his toes in boiling water. He said, of course, it's nothing to do with the minister, what museums show, they're autonomous. But given the outcry, I have decided in consultation with the museum that we're going to appoint an expert committee to examine half a dozen of the works. The situation remained the same until Monday, the start of this week, when the art newspaper, the printed edition, with this as the lead story. This prompted the Minister of Culture to step in a bit more firmly. And, well, he says it was a museum decision, but I have indications that it was probably a decision involving the Culture Ministry of Flanders, the city of Ghent, and the museum itself. The decision was to take was made to take all the works down. And they came down on Monday, within hours of our article being out there. Monday, luckily, in a way for them, happened to be the museum's closing day, so they could take these works down without anyone there to see it and cover up the embarrassing spaces with other works from storage. So that's getting pretty close to where we are now.
Yeah. I mean, one of the really striking things about this story is the sheer lack of attention that the museum paid to the lack of provenance, or the lack of published provenance, at least. So they were prepared to make a statement which said that the Toporowskis had confidential information that suggested that there was a provenance, but they didn't make that provenance public, which any museum, any collector worth their salt wants to make provenance public, because it absolutely shows how cast iron the works that are in their collection are.
Now, when it comes to documentation, when I went to interview Igor Toporowski, the collector, and his wife, Olga, they call it a joint collection, I interviewed them in their house in Brussels, and they did produce some documentation. They produced an old catalogue dated 1992 from the Kharkov Art Museum, featuring a photo of the Goncharova, which they were showing in Ghent, and this rather dog-eared catalogue looked pretty authentic. And I just said, oh, can I take a picture of the cover and of the inside pages which concern your picture? And he said, yes, fine. And I did that. I don't think he was expecting me to send it to the museum in Kharkov, which stayed this show, purportedly in 1992. And I just wanted to get their feedback. Do you remember the show? Were works for sale? This sort of thing. So I wasn't expecting any exciting lead, but the museum director in Kharkov got back to me pretty quickly, and she said this exhibition never happened. This is a catalogue that dates from 1998. The cover has been changed. The inside pages, which feature the Goncharova and another picture in Toporowski's collection, she said they've been doctored. These pictures were placed over existing pictures in the 1998 catalogue, and some of the text had been replaced. And it was clear that a fairly subtle but not undetectable transformation had been made with a view to fooling people like the director of the museum in Ghent into thinking the Toporowskis had cast iron provenance for this work and no doubt similar sort of evidence for other works.
I wonder if you would just give us a guide to a couple of the other examples where doubt has been cast over specific works in the collection.
There's a Rosanova futurist composition which features a bright red postage stamp with the head in profile of Nicholas II, who has the work supposed to date from 1915, and he was still on the throne, just that ostensibly would make sense. But I just thought to myself, well, Russian 25 kopeck stamp, which this was meant to be, did it actually look like that? And it didn't. Well, I suppose you could say Rosanova was inventing a stamp. Why she would do that, I don't know, but she could have done. But there weren't just one. There wasn't just one anomaly. There were three. First of all, Nicholas II's head never went on 25 kopeck stamps, presumably because they weren't important enough for the Tsar's head to go on them. His head went on other stamps, but it was always face on, never in profile as you'd get on a coin. And the third thing was it had a Russian inscription around the head, referring basically to Russian Imperial Post, but it wasn't an inscription that was ever used on Russian stamps. So that's an awful lot of suspect changes from the actual stamp that existed, and we can say that's suspicious rather than conclusive. Now, hanging next to this picture in Ghent, there was a Popova Café, a Cubist work called Café, dated 1914, presumably in Paris, which we know Popova visited for 3 months or so during 1914. And this intrigued me for a couple of reasons. It's a collage and oil painting work. And among the collage pieces which have been stuck on the canvas, there is an advert for French chocolate called Chocolat Meunier. And this is fairly standard thing to expect, I guess, in a work painted in 1914 with using bits of newspaper which probably were lying around or which he'd bought the day before. But it turns out that the person responsible for this work had not really cut out the headline or the Chocolat Meunier slogan very carefully. And just underneath there was a little phrase, a sort of advertising slogan, which is in German. So obviously this cutting came from a German newspaper, which it's surprising, especially 1914. Relations between France and German were not at their best, and any person in Paris found reading German newspapers could have been in a spot of bother, I guess. But anyway, again, that was suspicious rather than conclusive. But an Austrian journalist has recently analysed the text which has been stuck onto the canvas just below Chocolat Meunier, and he finds it's a Russian text, which is less surprising, of course, for Russian artists. But this Russian text has been cut out of a newspaper or magazine called Neva. It was a weekly, I suppose, magazine. It wasn't actually a daily newspaper in the sort of hard and fast sense. Anyway, it was a sort of cultural magazine that came out every week, and this article had been taken from it. Only it had been taken from an issue dated December 1916. And the painting is officially dated 1914. So, again, careless, lazy, you call it what you want, but it doesn't add up.
Right. So it's a story which has lots of potential developments on the horizon. Simon, thank you so much for talking to us about it. Now, Houser & Wirth Somerset is not your usual contemporary commercial art gallery. It's set just outside the quiet Somerset village of Bruton, with a view across fields to a medieval dovecote standing on a low hill nearby. Since opening in 2014, the gallery has made great efforts to be embedded in its community and rural life. Speaking to people in Bruton, it's clear that there's a certain pride in the presence of an international art world behemoth in this quiet West Country village. One woman told me that it has the nickname, seemingly affectionate rather than cynical, of How's It Worth It? The gallery's latest show is its most pointed reference to date to this bucolic locale. It's curated by Adam Sutherland, the director of Grisdale Arts, a strongly community-driven, non-profit arts organisation. Sutherland's show in Somerset, The Land We Live In, The Land We Left Behind, features work by more than 50 contemporary artists and numerous historic works and objects, many lent from public and private collections. It includes everything from Mark Imbaldo's famous fruit and vegetable portraits of the 16th century, through works by William Blake and Samuel Palmer, to John Martin and Paul Nash, as well as books, leaflets, posters, and all manner of quirky objects relating to rural existence through history. It is the antithesis of a commercial gallery exhibition. So how did this unique collaboration occur? Initially, I spoke to Alice Workman, the director of House and Verth Somerset. So how has it happened that House and Verth, a commercial gallery with a country outpost, is working with the man who runs Grisdale Arts, which is a sort of real grassroots community arts organisation?
Okay, well, House and Verth Somerset is about many different things. We have our exhibition programme here and focus on contemporary art, but there's many other elements that contribute to what House and Verth Somerset is: architecture, food, the landscape, the farm, the garden, our community and our education programmes. And we really wanted to create an exhibition that brought many of these elements together. And we have wanted to do an exhibition about the rural for a long time, ever since we opened, and we were thinking about who would be the right person to come and guest curate something really interesting for us here. And we approached Adam early last year and asked him if he might be interested, and started talking about what that show would look like. And he's been working very closely with our team here in Somerset for several months now to put the exhibition together.
I suppose what's really interesting is when I'm walking around this exhibition, it doesn't in any way look like a commercial show. It's absolutely the kind of show you would see in a museum. Do you see this place almost as kind of a private museum rather than another version of a House and Verth gallery like the ones that you have in London, New York and elsewhere?
I think House and Verth Somerset is unique, and it's not similar to any other model. Of course, we're a commercial gallery. We're very much a House and Verth gallery. However, we have a very public programme and public face here in Somerset. And, you know, it's a real hybrid between the public and the private. And this exhibition reflects that very much. So some of the works in the exhibition are for sale. Some are not for sale. Some come from public collections. Some come from private lenders. So it just reflects who we are, really.
Another thing that you've really built up over your time here is a kind of educational, a kind of outreach programme. And this show is probably the most active in that sense, isn't it? There's workshops, there's cheese making, there's all sorts of activities happening around, which actually not only reflect the kind of thematic structure of the show, but also relate very much to your locale.
Absolutely. That was part of the motivation for the show, was to really put together a really great events, outreach, activity programme, again, which highlights what we're all about. So we have goat milking demonstrations, we have cheese making workshops, we've got bread making workshops, we've got wonderful talks from local experts on people like Samuel Palmer, somebody coming to talk about truffles. So it's a fascinating programme, and we really hope it's a way for our audience to delve into the exhibition in a different way, to a different place.
In a sense, is this more of a labour of love than a part of the House and Verth business? I mean, is it a money-making concern, or does it operate in a kind of completely different way to the rest of the institution?
It's very much part of the business, and it's integral to the business, but it works in a different way as well. And I think House and Verth has such a variety of activities now all over the world, of different teams of people within the gallery focusing on different things, but all those different things make up what House and Verth are. And, you know, artists love coming here as much as they love going and having a show in our New York gallery. It's a different experience, and it's about creating different experiences and influences and inspiration for everybody who works with the gallery and who shows with the gallery.
You talk about the artists coming down here. They, in essence, they've often done residencies. With this show, it's a bit different, isn't it? Because there are a number of House and Verth artists in the show, but there isn't a sort of resident artist this time.
Has Adam, in essence, been your resident working, creative working person?
I guess so. In some way, Adam spent quite a lot of time with us down here in Somerset and exploring House and West Somerset and the team and getting to know how we work and Bruton and as a place. But the residency programme, sometimes the artists come and it leads on to an exhibition, but quite often they come for other reasons and to spend time making work for other projects or for a change of environment. So we've got residencies all throughout 2018, but they don't lead to any exhibitions.
Well, that's interesting. So artists kind of use this as a sort of creative bolt hole. They'll come out here and refresh, essentially.
Absolutely. And that's certainly what's happening this year. And we've got Rita Ackerman coming from New York, and she had an exhibition with us last year, but she loved Somerset and really loved the idea of coming back and using the studio to make work here. We have Matthew Day Jackson coming later in the year with his family for 3 months, and he has a show opening in our London gallery next month. So it's really a resource for our artists to come and use.
After speaking to Ellis, I sat down with Adam Sutherland. I initially asked what attracted him to the project.
I find Hauser and Wirth and what they're doing here very interesting. There's lots of connections between what they're doing here and what we're doing in the Lake District. There are different strategies and there are different ambitions, but there are and there are different effects on the local community and how that evolves and develops. But I'm very interested in lots of different models, and the model I guess I perhaps identify at Hauser & Wirth is in a way partly represented in the exhibition, the idea of a revised notion of an English estate. So there's a certain level of hierarchy within that, but there's also an ambition of participation and engagement with a very wide cross-section of people, drawn from a lot of different skill bases and different kinds of resources. And I'm really interested for us as well, the way that we work is similar. I view the rural as this body of resources that you can draw on, and it's the connections and collisions and the process that creates the energy and dynamism which makes that an exciting way to work, and for me in many ways more dynamic and exciting than working in a city.
And do you feel that this is a show that could be made for a museum, for instance, or do the very particular circumstances of this place feed into it?
It'd be really interesting to make it for a museum with a really big collection that one could draw from. But in effect, the show is a kind of it's public sector and social engagement, which is our kind of area, I guess, broadly, commercial, and like a museum show, and a little bit like a kind of Biennale kind of 100 artists, you know, survey kind of thing. So it's quite an interesting hybrid, a curious hybrid. And I'm very interested in that hybrid, in fact, the idea of a community, a heritage, and a contemporary program working in tandem. It's something that we're doing at the moment in our village of Coniston with the Ruskin Museum, the Mechanics Institute, and our own contemporary program.
One of the leading artists in the land we live in, the land we left behind, is Marcus Coates, who has developed a big international reputation as a performance artist over the last two decades. He's particularly interested in the natural world and has adopted the persona of animals as a means of addressing the dilemmas, personal, political, or anything in between, of people in various locations across the globe. In Somerset, his works punctuate the show, but the most striking is a suit made of apples which stands in the gallery's courtyard, somewhere between a scarecrow and a crucified figure. Coates donned this heavy armour when he adopted the persona of the Apple service provider and sat within a specially created Apple store on the show's opening weekend. Members of the public could book 45 minutes with him to address their problems. I sat in the Apple store with him to discuss the work just as the gallery was putting the final touches to the exhibition, hence the occasional banging door in our conversation.
Marcus, why are we sitting in this sort of very architectural space surrounded by apples.
It's very geometric. It's based on a cube system. And it was designed by Charlie Sutherland and made in collaboration with Grisdale. And in a way, it's a space they made, and I kind of activate it as an artist and use it and put it to purposeful function. They called it Anchorhold, based on the idea of the anchorites, who used to where priests could meet people in very small, secret, confined spaces. So in a way, we're sort of thinking about this as a quasi-spiritual space.
Something like a confessional.
It's in a way, it's a little bit similar. In a way, that's not really enforced, but that seems to tend to happen. People have the reaction of coming in here and wanting to talk about intimate things or things that are private. You can only really fit two people in here. So it's about that dynamic. So we've repurposed it as an Apple store. So we've got lots of apples here on different levels. So in a way, I wanted to think about this as a functional space around the tradition of the apple, the history of the apple, and what the apple is to us. And particularly the apple as a kind of complex fruit that's been managed and evolved by us, hybridized, cross-fertilized. In a way, it's kind of followed our own evolution as humans. And now we have this mass-produced singular varieties that bear little or no resemblance to their wild cousins. It's a bit like the evolution of the domestic dog and the wolf, you know. This apple is very different. So, it's an interesting... I think the apple is an interesting object in itself, but it's also interesting in terms of our relationship to nature, really.
In making this performance, you're asking people to come and talk to you about questions they want answered. Mm. This is rather like works you've made where you've kind of infused the spirit of animals into your answers to people when they have these particular probing questions into what might be personal questions or global questions. How will it manifest itself in terms of apples?
Well, it's very similar, really. I mean, all that work really is based on my own knowledge that's been derived from scientific sources or my own observation of animals. So it's knowledge of either an intimate relationship that I have with the world or nature, or someone else's observations. Now, this information is usually quite niche. It's either wildlife enthusiasts or scientists involved in this. So there was something about this information that I felt had value beyond describing itself. And this is where I'm connecting to this idea of this land lost, this idea of nostalgia for an old way of being, this idea that we've lost this connection to the land. And I think that in a way that's true. I think we've lost a lot of knowledge, and we've lost a lot of ways of creating attachments and relationships to the land and nature. So my idea moving forward is, okay, this knowledge is useful to us. How did people used to look at nature? They used to look to nature for their source of knowledge, and now we look to technology, branding, all sorts of things we have different relationship with where we get our knowledge from. So I'm looking to apples for knowledge now. So if you ask me a question about, I don't know, Trump or anything you're struggling with, you know, you can't answer rationally, I'll try and answer it exclusively by talking about the apple and deriving all that information and knowledge from the apple. So it's really relying on something that we don't think of as an authority in our lives. But I'm saying nature is an authority.
One of the striking things about your work is that you've repeatedly returned to nature. You've repeatedly called on nature as a kind of source of knowledge. Is your attachment to nature and your interest in it and your consistent reference to it something to do with art itself having turned away from nature?
Originally, I think, probably thinking about early 90s, the landscape within making art was kind of derisory, really. I mean, it was seen as extremely romantic and dismissed, the idea of working with the landscape. and then you had your Goldsworthys and your Nashes, and in a way that was still very romantic. I think what I recognised with my relationship with nature at that point was a huge amount of conflict, huge amount of confusion, and I think I looked to the my subjective values and recognised lots of cultural mediation that didn't work for me. Either it's too scientific, too romantic, too fascistic, too hippie, too this, too that, too cringy, too, you know, whatever it was, too anthropomorphic. So I think I saw nature almost as acultural. This is a place I could go to explore a sense of selfhood, a sense of what is it to be human. Of course, I quickly found out it's not acultural, and in a way, it's a state of mind. It's an idea, nature. So, so I've been working with that ever since. But I think consistently, particularly with this sort of performative process, I've been trying to link it to something pragmatic and useful. So, looking at not as is just in a nostalgic loss form, but saying what in our relationship with nature has been useful for us. Why have we created this theatricality around a relationship with folklore and folk ritual? What other cultures do that? What other cultures deem this relationship as necessary? What other cultures have used art in respect to their relationship to nature as necessary and life-saving? So yeah, that's why the question and answer thing is so important, because it's testing this relationship. What can we learn from the apple? I expect it might not come up with any answers, who knows, but I feel like I need to try and reinvest in something so humble and seemingly insignificant.
Marcus, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The Land We Live In, The Land We Left Behind is at House and Vert Somerset until the 7th of May. And that's all for this week. If you like the podcast, please subscribe and do tell us what you think on Twitter or Facebook at The Art Newspaper. You can also find us on Instagram at theartnewspaper.official. Thanks for listening. Until next week.